right. So tonight we are tackling like four chapters. So we're going to really fly through most of them. And thankfully, Millie touched on some of the chapters that I was going to cover, which is great because, like I said, we have a lot to dig into tonight. So let's start by reviewing kind of what we've learned from Becky about the structure of Genesis. And so we're going to see in, what she taught us was that in the first chapters, 1 through 11, they really focus in on the character of God and who he is. And then from chapters 12 on, we start centering on different characters who are important to the history of Israel and to the history of the Christian church as well. So the chapters we're covering tonight emphasize the choosing of Abraham over his nephew Lot. So we're going to see this big dichotomy between the two. And they also explain the existence of two of Israel's enemies, some groups that gave them trouble throughout their history. So in chapter 13 is where we're starting. We're covering 13, 14, and then 18 and 19 because they kind of go together as a unit. So essentially, we're talking about Lot tonight. And these are the places where he kind of shows up, he and Abraham showing up together in these parts of the story. All right, so in chapter 13, Abram returns to the place where he first called on the name of God. And we've seen Abram be a bit on the wishy-washy side, doing some things that really were not demonstrations of his faith, like pretending that his wife is a sister, things like that, right? But he's kind of coming back to a place where he built an altar to the Lord, and we're going to see him really be established in the next few chapters. And God's blessing has been abundant upon Abram, even though Abram hasn't been terribly faith-filled in the past few chapters. And Lot has come along for the ride and is benefiting from the blessings of Abram. And in fact, they're both benefiting so much that it begins to bring a conflict because there's not enough pasture lands for all their flocks, and their servants are beginning to fight with one another and argue with each other. So Abram's solution to that is just to allow Lot to choose what land he wants. And he says, let's just separate, and that way we can avoid this conflict. And so he just tells Lot, what do you want? And Lot looks around, and he's like, wow, that area right there looks fantastic. It's really fertile. I'll go there, and I'm going to really prosper. Like, you know he's got to be thinking that, right? Because it's a nice land with lots of room for his flocks and whatnot. And so he moves down toward Sodom, but Abram stays up near, up in Canaan. Okay, and verse 13 makes it clear that the direction he's going is not necessarily the best direction. Verse 12 says, Abram lived in the land of Canaan while Lot lived among the cities of the plain and pitched his tents near Sodom. Now the people of Sodom were wicked and were sinning greatly against the Lord. So we see him moving near, but not necessarily in. But in time, he moves closer and closer to Sodom, and eventually he's living in Sodom. And so that's pretty much 13 in a nutshell. I'm going to close with a quote from this Notes on the Pentateuch. He said, the man of faith can easily afford to allow the man of sight to take his choice. He can say, if thou wilt take the left hand, then I will go to the right. Or if thou depart to the right hand, I will go to the left. What beautiful disinterestedness and moral elevation we have here. And yet what security. It is certain that, let nature range where it will, let it take its most comprehensive grasp, its boldest and highest flight, There is never the slightest danger of its laying its hand upon faith's treasure. It will seek its portion in quite an opposite direction. Faith lays up its treasure in a place which nature would never dream of examining. And as to its approach thereto, it could not if it would, and it would not if it could. Hence, therefore, faith is perfectly safe as well as beautifully disinterested in allowing nature to take its choice. I thought that was a great illustration of how Abraham, or Abram at this point, had the faith to trust that God would provide for him, and just allowed Lot to take his choice. So chapter 14 is the war between the kings, and I think this is what Millie kind of hit on last week too. Essentially, for 13 years, these southern tribes, you have a map on your thing. Let me get my map out. So these southern tribes had been subject to King Chedorlaomer, and they decided to rebel. So what's happened is all these kings from the northeast have come down and are sweeping through to basically take back what they see as theirs. And in the process, Lot is swept up along with other captives from Sodom. And of course, booty and whatnot. So they've taken what they've wanted from Sodom and run off. And one man escapes and he goes to tell Abram, who in turn gets his own army together. He asks his friends nearby, like Mamre, and then he gets the men from his own household and he chases after them, and he's able to overcome these four kings who've swept down and just destroyed this region and taken what they wanted. He's able to go up with just the men in his household and a few friends, right? And he's been able to rescue Lot and bring him back and bring back the booty and return all of that stuff to the king of Sodom. So, and it's just a demonstration of God blessing Abram, because there's no, he's not of a greater strength. There's no way he had greater strength than these other kings, but he had the blessing of God behind him. And so it's just this continued fulfillment of the blessing that God gave him. Those who bless you will be blessed. Those who curse you will be cursed. So when he comes back, he's met by two kings, two very different kings, by Melchizedek and by the king of Sodom. So I'm going to read Genesis 14, 18 through 25, or 24. Then Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. He was priest of God Most High, and he blessed Abram, saying, "Blessed be Abram by God Most High, creator of heaven and earth. And praise be to God Most High, who delivered your enemies into your hand." Then Abram gave him a tenth of everything. The king of Sodom said to Abram, "Give me the people and keep the goods for yourself." But Abram said to the king of Sodom, "With raised hand, I have sworn an oath to the Lord God Most High, creator of heaven and earth, that I will accept nothing belonging to you, not even a thread or the strap of a sandal, so that you will never be able to say, 'I made Abraham rich.' I will accept nothing but what my men have eaten and the share that belongs to the men who went with me, to Aner, Eshcol, and Mamre. Let them have their share." Okay. So Abram's met by these two kings, Bera and Melchizedek. And to one he gives, a gift or a tithe, and to the other he refuses to receive a gift. And from one he receives a blessing. So it's pretty clear that Melchizedek is giving glory to God for this success that Abram has found, the victory that has come directly from the hand and the blessing of the Lord. And we are going to talk about Melchizedek a little bit. You can't hardly read the section without going to the verse in Hebrews that talks about him. So he's only appears here and in Psalm 110, and again in Hebrews. And so, I mean, really, in terms of like historical narrative, this is what we know about Melchizedek. And it's just amazing to me the author of Hebrews is able to go into so much just based on this short interaction that Melchizedek has with Abram. But what Psalm 110 does is it really, Psalm 110, 1 through 4, is a messianic psalm. So what it does is it connects Melchizedek to Messiah. All right? So Psalm 110, 1 through 4 says, "The Lord says to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies a footstool for your feet. The Lord will extend your mighty scepter from Zion, saying, rule in the midst of your enemies. Your troops will be willing on your day of battle. Arrayed in holy splendor, your young men will come to you like dew from the morning's womb. The Lord has sworn and will not change his mind. You are a priest forever in the order of Melchizedek." Okay, so this psalm is quoted as referring to Christ, the first verse of the psalm. And then the author of Hebrews uses the verse 4 in his argument that Christ's priesthood is better than the Levitical priesthood because it's eternal. And Melchizedek was not a Levitical priest. So Messiah is a new order of priest, so to speak. So, I mean, what we read at the beginning was a long passage, but he goes into depth as to what is so significant about this comparison between Melchizedek and Jesus. So he talks about Melchizedek in Hebrews 5, 6, and 7. 6 is really kind of it's the very last verse, so it's really going into chapter 7. In chapter 5, the way he talks about him, he quotes Psalm 110:4, and he says that he wants to talk more about Melchizedek, more about this, but that they're too weak to hear what he has to say, and that they're not mature enough to hear it. But in 6 and 7, the author points out, so he starts off pointing out the translation of Melchizedek's name, which means King of Righteousness. He also happens to be the King of Salem, the King of Salem, and Salem means peace. So he's the King of Peace and the King of Righteousness. He's also a priest of God Most High. So just as Christ is our King and our priest, Melchizedek holds both offices. And those are the only two spoken of that have been both priest and king. And so that's really the tie-in the author of Hebrews makes. The other interesting thing is that he points out the fact that Abram gave Melchizedek a tithe. And his point is that essentially through Abraham giving that tithe to Melchizedek, his progeny, the Levites, gave a tithe to Melchizedek. So it's just this pointing to the fact that Christ is better. Christ is better than the Levitical priesthood because he's of the order of Melchizedek. Now, Abram's interaction with the king of Sodom is completely different. He won't take a thing from the king of Sodom. And he wants no association with him. He doesn't want his name really to be mixed with Beer's name. And it's really unfortunate that Lot did not have the same attitude as he moved towards Sodom, because it would have saved him a lot of heartache in the end. But this chapter once again shows Lot benefiting from the blessing of Abram. Just having an association with Abram blesses Lot because of being saved from certain slavery, at least, at the best. And we see again God fulfilling his promise to bless those who bless Abram and curse those who curse him. So just to close out chapter 14, I don't feel like I did the Hebrews verse justice because it's so in depth and it's so rich. It's a good thing for us to study on our own. But I'd like to encourage us to follow Abram's faith. He heard of Lot's calamity and he had confidence that God would be with him. And he was. He was able to save his kinsmen. All right, so now we're going to head over to chapters 18 and 19. So on your order, on the back of the order of worship, at the bottom, I put a chiastic structure that I found in one of my commentaries. I think it was the New International Commentary on the New Testament. But I thought it was really interesting, and it just shows you how the chapters are really mirroring each other in a lot of ways. And there were also some verses that really matched up. So just for example, Abraham was sitting in the entrance to his tent when the visitors came, and Lot was sitting in the gateway to the city when the visitors came. They both hurried toward them. So verses, chapter 18, verse 2 says, when he saw them, he hurried toward them. 19:1 says, when he saw them, he got up to meet them. So you're just seeing these parallel verses that really go throughout both chapters, these interactions with the visitors who came to visit Abram and Lot. Okay. So obviously there's a number of disturbing events that transpire in this section of Genesis, but I'm hopeful that we can pull out some ideas that will encourage us who live in difficult times. So I'm not going to cover all of 18. We're mostly focused on 19, but we're just going to briefly talk about 18. So the first part is the announcement of the birth of a son. Okay, so we start with the birth announcement. And this section ends with a very different kind of birth announcement. So Abraham and Sarah have both had a stab at getting an heir, but now God is revealing to them his plan for an heir. So who is it that drops in for a visit with Abraham? We see him, okay, so he's offering quite a meal to these three visitors, right? He asks his wife to make bread, and he has his servant get a lamb ready, and they're going to have a feast. So he's showing great hospitality, and you don't necessarily, I don't think he knew who they were when they first came. He just saw them approaching, and he went out of his way to show hospitality to them. Initially, they're just called men, but it quickly changes to one of them being called Lord, name of God, as he begins to tell Abraham and Sarah that they'll have a child born to them in their old age. And then after in chapter 19, the other two men are identified as angels. So we have the Lord and angels having this meeting with Abraham. So the Lord announces that in a year, Abraham and Sarah will see a miraculous birth of a son. And Sarah laughs because she knows that she is way past the ability to give birth. This cannot happen. and she's never experienced a miracle before, right? So you can kind of understand why she would doubt their words. But she's about to be a key figure in a pretty big miracle. Okay, so we see again here God is showing the line of blessing, right? So that's also how it starts off, is you've got the appearing to Abraham, and he's going to have a baby. So we see that this line of blessing is going to continue on. We know that God did not choose Abraham and Sarah because they were fertile. The lineage God is granting them is a miraculous blessing. It's not natural, and it's not normal in any way. So after this exciting announcement, the Lord announces that he's going to judge and destroy Sodom. Okay, not the best, not you're going from really happy to really terrible, right? So let's read verses 16 through 21. Then the men rose up from there and looked down towards Sodom. And Abraham was walking with them to send them off. The Lord said, "Shall I hide from Abraham what I am about to do, since Abraham will surely become a great and mighty nation, and in him all the nations of the earth will be blessed? For I have chosen him so that he may command his children and his household after him to keep the way of the Lord by doing righteousness and justice, so that the Lord may bring upon Abraham what he has spoken about him." And the Lord said, "The outcry of Sodom and Gomorrah is indeed great, and their sin is exceedingly grave. I will go down now and see if they have done entirely according to its outcry, which has come to me. And if not, I will know." Notice that what he says Abraham will do, he will command his children and his household after him to keep the way of the Lord by doing righteousness and justice. Okay, so this is what stood out to me about this passage. Righteousness and justice. So just kind of keep that in mind. So the two angels leave for Sodom, and Abraham has time to intercede for Sodom. Really, you know he's got to be thinking about Lot, and he just wants to make sure that Lot is protected. So he appeals to what? He appeals to the righteousness and justice of God as he intercedes on behalf of Lot. In verse 25, he boldly asks, "Shall not the judge of all the earth deal justly?" In fact, he asks over and over again. He's looking for the threshold for the mercies of God. How many righteous people need to be in Sodom in order for the Lord to have mercy? He starts at 50 and he works his way down to 10. This sort of intercession isn't seen in this way anywhere else in the scriptures. We don't have any other examples of interceding. Moses definitely intercedes on behalf of Israel, but it's not in such a bold manner as Abraham. And I think he's a really good example to us of how to intercede on behalf of others and to love others by going to the Lord on their behalf and interceding for them. We can call upon God, we can cry out to him for those around us, and we do it corporately when we pray for the nations and church. And we're called to do it daily in personal prayer, right? So chapter 19 opens in the same way as 18. Just as Abraham was sitting at the door of his tent, Lot is sitting in the gate of the city. Both men go out of their way to show hospitality to the angels. But Lot's hospitality is very different. I don't have it written here, but if you just read it, it says, you know, basically he made them bread without yeast. And another thing that's kind of interesting is that his wife is not mentioned. No servants are mentioned. It's basically just Lot, and Lot's preparing the food for them. He also had to do a lot of convincing to get the angels to come with him. But I think that he knew the men of Sodom, and he was concerned for the safety of the visitors to their city. He knows what they're capable of. He knows what his fellow men in that city are capable of, and he wants to protect them. But in the end, we see this kind of turned on its head. So let's read verses 4 through 9 of 19. It says, "Before they had gone to bed, all the men from every part of the city of Sodom, both young and old, surrounded the house. They called to Lot, 'Where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us so that we can have sex with them.' Lot went outside to meet them and shut the door behind him and said, "No, my friends, don't do this wicked thing. Look, I have two daughters who have never slept with a man. Let me bring them out to you so you can do what you like with them. But don't do anything to these men, for they've come under the protection of my roof." "Get out of our way," they replied. "This fellow came here as a foreigner, and now he wants to play the judge. We'll treat you worse than them." They kept bringing pressure on Lot and moved forward to break down the door. So I'm sure that we have probably have different translations, and I think they translate it differently. This one's very blunt. The vocabulary used in the original language isn't exclusively homosexuality, but it can be used to refer to the sexual act. So it's like to know, bring them out here so we can know them. Some people treat it like abuse, but it appears to be more of a sexual act than simply abuse. And that it's really disturbing that he offers his daughters. And that does remind us of that story in Judges with the Benjamites and the concubine who was basically put in the same position. The women in neither situation had an opportunity to opt out of that. But here we see God protecting his daughters. And it's pretty clear what the men are after, right? For him to offer his daughters like that. So the New International Commentary on the Old Testament, which one is that? So I used these three, plus I read, we have an ancient commentary, which was really interesting. I'll tell you about it later, but. So this one, I'm going to quote that one. It says, it makes these observations. So rather than attempt to raise the moral conscience of the Sodomites, he offers to assuage their lust by handing over his two virgin daughters. So he's willing to make his daughters vulnerable for the sake of his guests, but he's not willing to offer himself. This is the same motif as what happened in chapter 12. With Sarai being offered to Pharaoh, which I didn't make that connection, but I thought that was really interesting when I read that. So you're just kind of seeing a similar pattern go on. You can also see the men of Sodom mocking Lot's authority to encourage good behavior. Although he was in the city gate, it's pretty clear that they still see him as a newcomer without any authority over them. And I was going to read another observation from this commentary. I thought was really good. It says, "To attempt to reprove the world's ways while we profit by association with it is vanity. The world will attach very little weight to such reproof and such testimony. Thus it was, too, that with Lot's testimony to his sons-in-law," which we haven't gotten to that part yet, "he seemed as one that mocked. It is vain to speak of approaching judgment while finding our place, our portion, our enjoyment in the very scene which is to be judged." I thought those were some really good words for us. Okay, so at this point, the men who Lot's trying to protect, the angels, really, pull him back into the house to protect him and his daughters from the men of Sodom. The narrative points out that it's not just young men or just old men, it's men from every age group, right? So it's pretty pervasive wickedness in this city. So let's read verses 10 through, I think I'm going to read all the way through 14. "But the men inside reached out and pulled Lot back into the house and shut the door. Then they struck the men who were at the door of the house, young and old, with blindness so that they could not find the door." Okay, so I'm going to stop here because this whole blindness thing is really interesting, I thought. The only other use of the Hebrew word for blindness is used in 2 Kings, and it's translated as a blinding light. So they make the point in the commentaries I read that you know, if they had all suddenly become blind, they would probably not have cared where the door was. But there was this sudden blindness that God brought upon them, so that they're like trying to find it, but they can't see well for whatever, for because of what God did, you know, to protect them. Okay, verse 12 says, the two men said to Lot, do you have anyone else here, sons-in-law or sons or daughters or anyone else in the city who belongs to you? Get them out of here, because we are going to destroy this place. The outcry to the Lord against its people is so great that he has sent us to destroy it. So Lot went out and spoke to his sons-in-law who were pledged to marry his daughters. He said, hurry and get out of this place because the Lord is about to destroy the city. But his sons-in-law thought he was joking. And we see a parallel between this laughter of the sons-in-law and Sarah's laughter at the promise of God. So you've got two promises, right? A promise of judgment they laugh at, and then promise of a blessing that gets laughed at. So with the coming of dawn, the angels urged Lot, saying, hurry, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, or you will be swept away when the city is punished. It was not easy to get Lot and his family out of Sodom. They were very comfortable there. They saw their futures there. This is where Lot's daughters were going to be married and raise their children. Lot and his family don't seem to want to leave, despite the horrible behavior of the inhabitants and how careless they are about harming Lot's family. Verse 16 says, when he hesitated, the men grasped his hand and the hands of his wife and his two daughters and led them safely out of the city, for the Lord was merciful to them. As soon as they had brought them out, one of them said, flee for your lives. Don't look back and don't stop anywhere in the plain. Flee to the mountains or you will be swept away. But Lot said to them, no, my lords, please, your servant has found favor in your eyes, and you have shown great kindness to me in sparing my life. But I can't flee to the mountains. This disaster will overtake me, and I'll die. Look, here is a town near enough to run to, and it is small. Let me flee to it. It is very small, isn't it? Then my life will be spared. He said to him, very well, I will grant you this request too. I will not overthrow the town you speak of, but flee quickly, because I cannot do anything until you reach it. That is why the town is called Zoar. By the time Lot reached Zoar, the sun had risen over the land. Then the Lord rained down burning sulfur on Sodom and Gomorrah from the Lord out of heavens. Thus he overthrew those cities and the entire plain, destroying all those living in the cities and also the vegetation in the land. But Lot's wife looked back, and she became a pillar of salt. So how abundant is the mercy and kindness of God? He saves Lot and his daughters in spite of their hesitation. Lot's wife looks back in direct defiance and is destroyed. Doesn't indicate that she was necessarily longing for Sodom, but she was certainly not single-minded in her obedience. One of my commentaries quoted a commentator who said, before divine judgment, there is only the possibility of being smitten or of escaping, but no third alternative. So that's what she is for us, is an example of that. And in Matthew 1:5, Jesus says, remember Lot's wife. Whoever tries to keep their life will lose it, and whoever loses their life will preserve it. So that's really what Lot and his daughters end up doing. They end up leaving everything, essentially losing their lives in order to survive, right? And they have nothing. They're left with nothing. In Luke 9:62, Jesus says, no one who puts his hand to the plow and looks back is fit for service in the kingdom of heaven. I thought that was pretty appropriate for this as well. I think it's a good reminder to us of where we need to keep our eyes set, author and finisher of our faith. So we don't really know exactly what kind of supernatural disaster this was. It could have been a sudden earthquake, but if so, sulfur must have been like exploding from the ground, because because it's described as being rained down from heaven. But what we do know is everything was destroyed, vegetation, everything. It doesn't mention any animals, but certainly if there were any animals in that area, they would have all been destroyed, along with people, vegetation, everything. Verse 27 says, early the next morning, Abraham got up and returned to the place where he had stood before the Lord. He looked down toward Sodom and Gomorrah, toward all the land of the plain, and he saw dense smoke rising from the land like smoke from a furnace. So when God destroyed the cities of the plain, he remembered Abraham, and he brought Lot out of the catastrophe that overthrew the cities where Lot had lived. So once again, we see Lot's association with Abraham is key. Why did he save Lot? Because he remembered Abraham. Yeah. So just when you thought it couldn't get any worse, like you feel like you're at the end of all the tragedies there could be, it gets worse. So in verse 30, it says, Lot and his two daughters left Zoar and settled in the mountains, for he was afraid to stay there. Now, it doesn't tell us why. I don't know. Maybe it has to do with, you know, we just had all these kings sweep through and destroy these areas. It could have been that. It could have been fear that God would eventually bring punishment on Zoar, but we don't really know why. But he was fearful. So he and his two daughters lived in a cave. They left there and they went and lived in a cave. So one day, the older daughter said to the younger, our father is old, and there is no man around here to give us children, as is the custom all over the earth. Let's get our father to drink wine and then sleep with him and preserve our family line through our father. That night, they got their father to drink wine, and the older daughter went in and slept with him. He was not aware of it when she lay down or when she got up. The next day, the older daughter said to the younger, last night I slept with my father. Let's get him to drink wine again tonight, and you go in and sleep with him, and so we can preserve our family line through our father. So they got their father to drink wine that night also, and the younger daughter went in and slept with him. Again, he was not aware of it when she lay down or when she got up. So both of Lot's daughters became pregnant by their father. The older daughter had a son, and she named him Moab. He is the father of the Moabites of today. The younger daughter also had a son, and she named him Ben-Ami. He is the father of the Ammonites of today. So this is the irony, right? Lot's ready to give his daughters to the men of Sodom. But in the end, his daughters have children by him. So it's this flipping again of the situation. And they give birth to the Moabites and the Ammonites, two nations that end up kind of causing trouble for Israel and being very difficult, having problems with them. The line of Abraham continues through a miraculous birth. Lot's line continues through drunken incest. So we see this really big division now between Abraham and Lot. It's pretty clear which one is the line of God's blessing. What are some things that we can learn from this really terrible chapter? So the first thing I want us to think about is, with whom do you most identify in these stories? Let's skip that one. Let's just think about that one. But how would you describe Lot from what we read here? What would be your, like, what would you say about Lot if you were explaining him to someone else?
Selfish. Cowardly.
Weak. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Pretty weak. Yeah. Well, how is he described in 2 Peter 2, 6 through 9? Let's look at it. Can someone read that when they get it? I think I have the right reference there.
If by turning the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah to ashes, he condemned them to extinction, making them an example of what is going to happen to the ungodly, and if he rescued righteous Lot, greatly distressed by the sensual conduct of the wicked. For as that righteous man lived among them day after day, he was tormenting his righteous soul over their lawless deeds that he saw and heard. Then the Lord knows how to rescue the godly from trials and to keep the unrighteous under punishment until the day of judgment.
Wow. I mean, that's not what we initially think of Lot. I don't. But God knows his heart, you know, and he knew that Lot knew the men were wicked. I mean, that's why he wanted to rescue the angels, not knowing they were angels. He thought he needed to protect them, right? He's incapable of doing so. But I think it's a good reminder for us that that sometimes people aren't necessarily what they seem. And we need to look at people through God's eyes and remember that they're created in the image of God. And this is why God did rescue Lot, because he was not partaking in the wickedness of the city. He was surrounded by it. And you've got to know his daughters were influenced by it, by their actions that they took later. But that didn't really change who Lot was in his character. He's called righteous 3 times in 2 Peter. So I put a couple of questions, I guess, on the orders, back at the order of worship. So we kind of already talked about number one. What can we learn about Abraham's interaction in 18:23-32 regarding intercessory prayer? We do need to pray for each other and really care for each other deeply, just like Abraham cared for Lot. How is Lot's ineffectiveness in Sodom a warning to us? I think that's something that I think that kind of came through in the passage that I read, is that if we're engaging, if we are living in a way that compromises the gospel, compromises our faith, we're not going to be able to speak truth into other people's lives in the same way as if we live separated and apart. And I think that's kind of was his problem, was that he was too inside. He was too much a part of the community.
And it seems like he didn't.
Yeah, go ahead.
He didn't say anything. Like even 2 Peter 2 said he was tormented in his soul.
Yeah.
But he was living there, not speaking out against it.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe that's another lesson. Like, we can't just live in the world and just, okay, well, I have my beliefs and my private Christianity, and I live holy life inside my house, but,
and inside my heart.
Right. But, speaking out against wrong and giving the gospel and, speaking about holiness.
So it talks that, in verse 9 it says he is acting like a judge. So they must have been bothered by his actions in the past. And we hear that now. We speak out and they say, who are you to judge me? So I wonder what's going on there. Because they certainly felt like he was judging them at some point.
Mm-hmm. Something else I thought we should consider is, how do the Moabites fit into the history of Israel? If we look at Matthew 5:1, who do we see mentioned? Okay, I thought so. I was like, I think it's Matthew 1:5. Did I write Matthew 5:1? Oh, I did. It's like, that's really the wrong location. Matthew 1:5. It's the genealogy of Christ. And Salmon, the father of Boaz, by Rahab. And Boaz, the father of Obed, by Ruth. And Obed, the father of Jesse. So who was Ruth?
Moabite.
Right. So who they were at one point in time excluded from temple worship and everything. So it's pretty so God can redeem really bad situations.
And I do tend to think about the Moabites, like when you read about them and, oh, you know, we're not supposed to mix with the pagan lands around us. We think of them as something other, you know, but really they were originally part of, I mean, a direct descendant of Abraham's family line. So they weren't as other. They just got really corrupted.
Yeah.
Yes. You know, so Uriah's wife. She was also in the genealogy. She's called Uriah's wife, which is interesting.
Not the best story there either.
Exactly.
All right, is there anything else, any comments that you guys have?
I wish, as I was going through, I just thought that it was so compassionate of Abraham to continue to look after Lot the way that he did.
Yeah.
I mean, I just imagine, like, if you had this family member, and even though you made this proposal, you choose, and he chose this great land, just, you know, the bitterness that could have already started to fester inside of him, and yet he went, and he was concerned about him multiple times to pull and to draw him back, and I feel like we oftentimes, when we have this block against somebody in our lives, we just say, okay, well, I've tried to make amends with them, but it's not working, so I'm not going to pursue them anymore. And I think Abraham's lesson to us there is that he, as you said in the beginning, he was much more concerned with being faithful to God than the sight of the things that were present there.
I think he took seriously his commitment to pass on what God had told him, you know, because Lot was part of his nephew, so he keeps feeling this responsibility to bring it back, and he takes that seriously.
Yeah.
And I think we probably, you know, we don't, like, we just sort of are like, well, whatever, you know, let that person do their own.
Even to family,
thing. Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
We'll be like, well, whatever.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. I keep helping them, and then they keep getting trouble.
Right.
Yeah.
It just happens over and over again. He's long-suffering.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And maybe Abraham did rub off a lot, because maybe that was part of it, said his righteous soul. Mm-hmm. And it was great. Maybe there was a lot more interaction than we see in the scripture. Maybe there was a discipline going on.
It is interesting that you don't hear anything more about Lot, really, after this. But he's moving further east, too. So that's what I liked about this map, is that they had Zoar on there. It's kind of at the southern eastern tip of the Dead Sea.
And Lot lived in Ur. Just like Abraham. Like he lived in that. He was, you know, taken too. We don't know how much younger he was, you know, but he didn't have a great upbringing, you know, in the pagan land.
Yeah.
So God must have done a work in his heart because he calls him righteous.
It's true. It may have been why God was understanding, I mean, more understanding than we would think. When he let his wife go to Pharaoh, because he understood what he'd grown up with and how this was a process for him.
Mm-hmm. He was gracious to him.
Yes, he was.
Mm-hmm. Oh my God, sorry. All right, Millie, do you